This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 15 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
We are so absolutely thrilled and tickled and everything to be back. And I know we said that a few times this year.
Good Lord.
But we really are back.
I feel like every time we do a new episode, we have to start by saying, we're so glad to be
back. Well, if you follow, we do not cross promote or anything like that as far as on our actual shows. But if you, I think we've mentioned before that this is our second podcast, and our other one follows the Outlander series. And if you know anything about Outlander, even if you don't know the story, it's on the air right now. When Outlander is on the air, it's enough to get that show out. The shizzle gets real. So it is through the magic. Did you see somewhere that I threw that word in there? Magic.
I mean, it was kind of hard to miss. I rolled really hard.
It was through the magic of, basically, I'm not going to lie, Outlander taking a week off.
In sports, we call that a bye week.
A bye week. Outlander, thank the gods and Diana the Huntress that had a bye. So we were able to squeeze in an extra recording. And so we're super excited to resume our chapter by chapter read along of A Discovery of Witches.
So this I would say this week, but that implies that we've been doing this weekly.
You can't say that.
So we'll just say this episode, we will be discussing chapter 14. I'm going to tagline this chapter, Diana sucks at flirting.
That's fair. Yeah, that's cool. So that's right. So since it's been a little while, the chapters have only numbers and no titles. And what we've been doing, I think the last two chapters or so, Summer and or guest, because we've had Candida on, Summer and or guest kind of at the top, kind of throw out what their inspired title is just from their reading and before we even actually chat about the chapter. So say that again, Sam.
I think I said Diana sucks at flirting.
Yes. Okay. I think that's not unfair.
She's trying real hard though. So I'm going to have to give her props.
I give her major props. Okay. So, we started this as well. I don't think we've done this. We haven't done it enough to establish this as our pattern, but hopefully as we get into the fall, the most magical season of all, first of all, Abraham, second of all, did you hear I put the word magic in there again?
Oh my God. Are you going to do that every time you say magic? If you do, I'm going to outlaw the word magic.
No, you can't. This is a discovery.
You're going to have to come up with a new word.
Magi?
No.
Magique?
No.
I don't even know how to say it in French. Magie. No. Probably
it
magique.
It can't be a word that actually means magic. It has to be a nonsense word that I'm not sick of.
Abracadabra?
No, that is already associated with magic.
Okay, so what we tried to do, at least I think two episodes ago, at least the last time, which was episode 14, we had Candida visiting us, and we said at the beginning, what is your drink of choice? Remember that?
Oh, like what are we drinking right now?
Exactly. Uh-huh. What's your brew? What's your brew?
Hold please. I'm like, I'll be back in two shakes of a lamb's tail.
Shake, shake. Okay. So Summer, we're still waiting for Summer. Meanwhile, through the magic of editing, you will hear no delay. I just took off and got a glass of champagne because that's what I have. I didn't want to, this is like a kind of a romantical chapter. I didn't want to get like Outlander boozy. So I'm not doing any whiskey, although it's never inappropriate to have your drink of choice, but I have a flute of champagne. Of course, it's not champagne. I think it's Trader Joe's Schloss Biberich, which is German for Schloss Biberich.
Okay, I'm back.
I have.
You totally missed it. What did I miss?
Well, you left. I said shake, shake, because you said two shakes of a lamb's tail. I was totally joking. So I said shake, shake, and you were still gone, obviously. I put my headphones down, and I got I grabbed a champagne flute and opened, I didn't open it. I grabbed a bottle of champagne that was already open, like from last week. And I poured like a half a glass of champagne. And I already like shared with our listener what I have. You missed it, but you're back. So tell us what you have. What's your brew?
I brewed a cup of coffee with a generous end of my Bailey's bottle.
Oh, that's cool.
It was not a whole shot of Bailey's, but it was all the Bailey's that was left in the bottle. So
as we did, as we have done in the past, and we do our, even if it's just water, we do our best to carry it forward. This evening, as we record, I am enjoying, as I was telling our listeners, I'll share it with you as well. I am enjoying a half a champagne flute of Trader Joe's Schloss Biberich. So now, dear listener, we invite you, if you don't have anything yet, to grab a glass of your favorite, a glass or a cuppa, whatever you like to snuggle in with, and enjoy our discussion of chapter 14. So the last chapter, we left our hero and heroine at her apartment, Matthew having accompanied her home. Chapter 14 opens later that evening at 7:30 p.m. Matthew is waiting for Diana at the lodge. We're reminded of his flair for the monochromatic, as Deb describes what he's wearing. And she is wondering what they're going to do, where they're going to go, and where they're going to eat. And he says they're dining in college.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Are you, since there have been castings and they're filming and it's all over the internet, are you starting to envision the actors cast in the roles?
That's a good question. Now, again, not comparing it to the story of Outlander, but comparing this experience to our experience of having begun the Outlander podcast before there was much casting, at least. I have to say, I think because we had Outlander so much for so many years, like 15 more years before this started, I had solidly like faceless. I had ideas of like facial shapes or body type or whatever, but nothing really solid as far as like an image of like, oh, it looks like so-and-so. For these books, I find I am more easily naturally adapting to the faces of those who have been cast. And even though I've not read it, you know, like I haven't read the books like five times, I've read them, I believe, 2.5 times. I haven't gotten through all three times, but I've read two of them 3 times and one of them, the last one, twice. So I think because of the length of time, and even though they've been out for a number of years, I didn't find them until you introduced me to them. And that was what, late 2014, early 2015, something like that. And so they're still new in my schema as compared with how long I had the story of Outlander in my mind when we began that show. So does that answer your question, kind of? As soon as they were cast, I did not automatically see them. Like, I see them playing it. I totally envision them on screen. But when I read it, I don't necessarily see their faces. Like, it's not 100%. But they are absolutely, definitely starting to embody them as I read. Yes.
I feel currently that because they've been so newly cast, and because I have been reading the books for a few years now, that I am currently in the phase of round hole characters in my book and the square peg actors and me aggressively shoving them into the round hole. Because I'm like, every time I'm reading Matthew and she's describing, you know, what he's wearing and all those things, I'm like going, Matthew Good, what does he look like? Does he look like this? Okay, I'm putting him in this part. I'm trying to envision what he's going to look like when he does this. It's not taking anything away from the story. In fact, it's kind of adding a level of humor to me. So I'm okay with it, but I am not fully married to the actors they've cast yet, but I'm trying to be.
Well, yeah. And as we know, and as has been the All Souls discussion group, which is the largest All Souls group that we know of on, I think that exists, the largest community currently that's on Facebook, is a wonderful space. We'll provide the link in the show notes. In case you guys have not joined, we wholeheartedly recommend them. They have, I mean, Deb participates there, obviously on her page she does as well, but she, I mean, imagine like one of your favorite authors in this group. In this group where you're at talking about these books, the author stops in. I mean, how incredibly amazing is that? How lucky are we that we have such interaction. So all that to say, the reason I brought them up is because they have such great conversations. They, of course, the real-time read-along, which is every fall, it's an annual discussion that goes through a discovery of witches in a specific amount of time as the events occur in the book, which is pretty freaking awesome. I'm sorry. That was pretty awesome. So anyway, the greatest thing, one of the best things beside an amazing community about this group is that they have so many, you can read about the actors, you can read about people responding to their being cast, how they are, just like Summer and I shared, how they are, or maybe for you, they aren't coming into the book story at all. Maybe they're simply the embodiment, as they are, for the television adaptation, as they absolutely 100% are. But one of the greatest things about that group, if you're not there yet, we would advise you to join, is that there's such community there. There's such conversations. And the little things that Summer and I kind of may pop into is it's there on a much wider and grander scale. And also, it's people who know these books backwards and forwards. And it is amazing to see such a community. So to continue the chapter, they are dining in college, Matthew says, but they are not dining at High Table. Now, I have to tell you, I've dined at High Table exactly once. I don't know if I've shared on this podcast, but I had the fortune and the student loans to prove it to study at...
the fact that you had student loans means you didn't have a fortune.
No, I had a good fortune. Well, I had to apply to get in, girlfriend.
I was using double speak.
Got it. So I was able to study at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland for a year. And the reason it was only a year is because the program I did, a postgraduate diploma, was only a year program. So that's why I was there for a year and not longer. And of course, it's Scotland. It's amazing. That's my happy place, all that. But one time I was able to eat at High Table, and it was an experience. I don't know if it was all grad students, as they say, all post grad. But there was you could kind of sign up for it. They had openings it took, sometimes if you got on a wait list or whatever, it could take, a few months to be called in. But I expressed interest, or I heard someone talking about it. And so I'm like, oh, that would be kind of cool, because in the cafeteria, I don't know if it's called that, in the large room where everyone ate, in the dining hall, it was like, legit, like you think of this classic, like,
was it like Harry Potter?
Yeah, except the tables were the other way around. It's like, rather than long tables along, and they're going the same way the room was long, the tables were perpendicular to the length of the room. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So at that point, so I had a meal plan the first semester. You would go in, you had your pass or whatever, you got in line, you got your food, you got a tray, everything, and you went in and to this big hall and you sat down and you ate. And up at the front of the room, they're on a platform, like raised, like on steps, like a dais, I guess you'd call it. There was this beautiful fancy table, like wooden table with these big chairs and everything. And that was High Table, literally a table that's higher than the rest of us. And I never knew like what it was or what the criteria was. I always thought, look, I am not from here. I don't know these traditions. Obviously, this is something that is important in some manner, at least to some people. But surely, that's just not for me. It's gorgeous to look at. I mean, I'd love to do it, but how am I, as a foreigner, I wasn't an undergrad here. And let me say, I was a grad student, a postgrad, and I stayed in a different dorm. But if you were where I was, if you were a postgrad, and the dorm I was in was called Gannicky House, you can Google it. It's on North Street in St. Andrews. And if you stayed in, that was the graduate dorm, the postgrad dorm. If you stayed in that dorm and were on a meal plan, so you could totally be self-catered or catered to the meal plan. If you chose to go through the hall and be catered, then even our house, had like four levels. There were rooms, kitchens on each level because it was mostly self-catered. But if you were a postgrad staying in Gannicke and you had a meal plan, then you had to kind of trek it over to this larger, absolutely stunning, stunning residence hall called St. Salvator's. It was gorgeous, ridiculously gorgeous. Like, just like out of Harry Potter, just like out of whatever you could imagine. That's what it was. So you go across the St. Salvator's Hall and there's like, you know, through the front door, through, say hi to the porter or whatever. You go through and you go to the area like in the back and you go through to get your food. So I had to like make a beeline, like run across this big quad anytime, you know, it was mealtime. So I go in there. Anyway, that was the way we came through and then continued to, as I described earlier. And I was interested in, I was one of very few postgrads. There may have been like people that I knew or that I recognized from our dorm. I mean, like four people. There may have been more that were catered. I only remember consistently seeing a number of people. And so I was like, I know you, you're a postgrad. I'm going to sit next to you. So I didn't know anyone. So I remember seeing this high table and I finally, I don't know if I asked around or if someone was promoting it, but I learned about, I guess, a list or someone you emailed to get on it. And I did. And I'm like, okay, well that will probably never happen. But I finally got a call and I was like, oh, got it. So it was like some day of some month and just, you know, be dressed smartly and, you know, nice shoes, no like prom dresses, nothing like that, but just, you know, dress up a little bit, no jeans. But they did have like a certain dress code. It wasn't really strict, but it was definitely something that you adhered to. And, the oddest thing about eating at High Table was when I entered, all these things are coming back to me. So you went through the entryway and the porter met you and you went into this like side room. So only people at High Table could go to this little side room. And I'm not joking. They had like hors d'oeuvres and they had like little tiny like little glasses that they serve sherry and port in. Like really tiny glasses. They were like pouring us port, like everything. I was like, dang. So I had this port. It was like a dream. It was seriously, it was amazing. So probably like 10 of us, 15 of us, I don't know. So we have a little port or whatever they're serving. And then when it's a few minutes after most of the diners are seated, then we go in. Now, if you're eating at a High Table, you do not get a tray and walk in with your food. You go and
You don't?
No, you don't. You go in and I'm not joking. I mean, I don't think there's any music. I think I would remember if there were music. Thank God there was no music. But you did. You literally walked in a line and got up and, you know, sat. I don't think we stood behind our seats, but we may have. But I know we like filed in single file, sat at our seats. I think they were assigned. I could be wrong, but they literally knew every single person there because you had to sign up for that or be chosen or be asked. And so I was not asked. I asked to be there and they had an opening. So I was allowed to be there. And so you finally sit down. And then if I'm not mistaken, I believe you were served. And this is all up on this dais in front of all the people who were eating their food. It was a little embarrassing, but it was awesome. So that's High Table. So you talk about someone who doesn't like to be the center of attention. Like Diana, right? No, she's, I get it. It's fun. I would do it once for the experience. It was fun. So he says, alas, no High Table. Or he just says, nope, not High Table. And they're walking. And Diana, as they walk, they chat. And Diana, they keep going because she's like, I have no clue where you're taking me. She's like, there's no way. You're taking me. I know where you're headed. She's incredulous. She cannot believe. She says, or she finds out that Matthew belongs to the most exclusive college. Of course, the one that gives our beloved trilogy its name, All Souls College. She stops and looks at him and says, you aren't. And he takes it perhaps the wrong way. She's not afraid of him, of being alone with him or with him. She's not upset in any way that he might be a member of the college. She's just like, after all the stuff you told me of like how many degrees you have, how fascinating you are, you know, how, I mean, not that he's gloating or anything like that, but he's told her at least a little bit of like all these things he's accomplished. And she's like, seriously, you are all that in a bag of nuts. I mean,
bag of nuts. Usually, it's what's the chips?
Phrase?
Oh. Are you thinking about balls, Ginger?
Summer, no.
Are you thinking about ball sacks? Bag of nuts. You're fired.
I don't know where that came from, honestly. No.
Bag of
so,
nuts.
So she stops and says, "You aren't." And she's not afraid of being alone with him or with him. Rather, she's never been inside All Souls. He, however, thinks that she might not want to be around him. So this is, again, they're both working on their communication skills. They're making assumptions, which we know what that does. And he wraps up All Souls College with, quote, "It's just a collection of people in a set of old buildings," unquote.
But see, that's such a vampire response because yep. he has completely and utterly lost touch with reality. He has no concept of
exactly
of all of the
normal person,
right, the prestige that comes along with it. This isn't just that he belongs to this prestigious college. He's belonged to many colleges, some of them several times. And there are people who never belong to any colleges. So I'm like, and even he acknowledges, well, this is the first time All Souls has taken notice of me in like the, you know, however many centuries he's been going to college, which can I just tell you, I don't know that that would be what I would do with my life. I don't know that I like college that much that I would want to keep going. But to each his own. But he just has no concept of what a scholar and what a, you know, a historian of the gravitas of what he's accomplished in his life. I think he's completely lost touch of reality.
I don't think he's lost touch with reality as far as like, he's not a sociopath. He's not crazy. He's not psychotic is what I mean, but he's not delusional. However, yes, I agree. He is not normal by any sense of the word, and he cannot, and understandably so, understand or comprehend any longer what normal really is.
Well, and he almost seemed mildly annoyed by it. He's like, ugh, let's get this over with. I've belonged here. I went to this college. I went to that college. Are you done being impressed now? Can we move on to me telling you how pretty I think you look in this light?
So it is quite prestigious. And there are only 6 dozen fellows in this college and no students. Matthew then tells her, quote, "We're going to my rooms," unquote. So this is his rooms in All Souls College. Matthew is beginning to relax around her again, as well as he gets closer to a comfortable place for him. And that is All Souls College. Deb writes, quote, "Matthew relaxing into the darkness with every step, as if in the company of an old friend," unquote. When Jennifer Ikeda narrates, quote, "Matthew looked down with a shy smile. Welcome to All Souls," unquote. I just put a big fat heart. I loved it, Jennifer. Her delivery of that is so, it's like a big shiz eating grin. He's just so happy right there.
But I feel like for people to fully understand what that means to Diana, they need to interchange that word with something they've always wanted to see but never been allowed to. So like so welcome to
an underground at Disneyland,
Willy Wonka's factory, or you know, just,
but underground at Disneyland actually exists.
Yes, of course it does. Why wouldn't it exist?
Willy Wonka does not exist.
It might. You don't know.
No, it doesn't. Those were all special effects.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Although, hold on a second.
Speaking of, hold on a sec, Willy Wonka. If we can just talk about that movie. And I know apparently the second one with, what's his name, Johnny Depp, was actually more, I guess, closer to the book. I haven't read the book. But in that 70s or 80s version, which of course you and I grew up with, I have to say my favorite scene, not what happens, but the setting of any movie at any point in the history of movies that I've ever seen.
Please tell me it's the candy room that everything is edible.
Yes!
Okay, this would be the equivalent of...
Oh my gosh!
So for them to say All Souls, welcome to All Souls, it would be Willy Wonka saying, "You can eat anything in this room." That would be my equivalent.
Oh, that's the best room ever.
You can lick the wallpaper.
So, seriously, I loved Deb's description of the college of a, quote, "the love child of a wedding cake and a cathedral." That's the best, Deb. That was awesome. Because you can totally, you can imagine it, or you might think, oh, what does that look like? If you look at the All Souls College, you see the grandiosity of a cathedral, right? The beautiful, classic structure, detail of a cathedral. And then you have this like big fat tower in the middle, or big fat like squat thing. And that's the wedding cake. It's so perfect. It's just, I wonder if she made that up or if it's something like she had heard, you know, when she was studying at Oxford. But so the further they go into All Souls, they're actually in the college now, the more boy-like and fun-loving Matthew seems to be getting.
He's becoming Willy Wonka. I'm not kidding. He's taking
That's true. You're right. You're right. Okay. So I can just see here in this scene, here I saw them. I can see Matthew Good leading Teresa Palmer through the grounds of All Souls College. This was, I had no problem at all. And even Diana is enjoying herself and teases him. Quote, "It's a good thing I'm a witch. The sight of you here would be enough to scare a human to death." Unquote. So as they are getting deeper into All Souls, there is more secrecy and more security. He urges Diana to have patience, but she reminds us that patience is not a strong suit of Bishop women. He turns on a light, and they're now in his rooms. They've gone through like keys and all this stuff, and he turns on a light, and it looks like, quote, "horse stalls for miniature Shetland ponies," unquote. And there's a strange smell in the air, and it was the smell of stale alcohol. Of course, this is wine. It's a type of one of the wine cellars or wine storage areas there. And there were crates and crates and crates of wine. Bins from World War I, World War II, quote, "bottles that Florence Nightingale might have packed in her trunks for the Crimea."
It should be noted that this is his personal wine cellar.
Yes.
And
these are his rooms.
And it's not his rooms, because it's not.
No,
this is his wine cellar. He has rooms elsewhere because they take the wine back to his rooms.
These are his own area. This is his own personal area at All Souls College. Part of it.
But the way that I read it, they were two separate areas. Like they had wine cellars that people, because they would be in completely different areas.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're right. No, because he goes into it and then he leaves and then they go somewhere else because they're carrying that wine around.
Correct. So they're not, that was all the only distinction I wanted to make is that he has a wine cellar.
This is not his personal room.
And he has rooms.
This is either his personal wine cellar or his personal part of a wine cellar.
So it's to be noted that the prestige of being a member of All Souls College not only comes with being a member of All Souls College, but apparently it also comes with your own private wine cellar.
Or at least a room that you can fill with wine.
Right.
And then there are more locked doors. Matthew opens one, and by candlelight, Diana sees an orderly space covered in dust. And we're going back a little bit because this is them entering before they actually collect those wines. This is a private cellar. She asks him what he could possibly have in there that they didn't just walk by. Now, he's still in a very good mood. He says, quote, "all sorts of things," unquote, and smiles mysteriously. Then he starts just handing her bottles, a Dom Pérignon, one from the year she was born, so 1976. And as soon as I read that, I went, ha, because I knew that. But when you read it, it's like, reminds me. Diana and I are both bicentennial babies. Thank you so much, Deb. I love it. And she's a Leo, so shaka. We're both Leos. I don't know what shaka is, but there you go.
I don't either.
Me either. So they take bottles, and he gives her more bottles, and then he takes some as well. And they head up to his rooms. Excuse me. Now, his rooms are smaller than hers at New College. And because of this area, we're reminded of his height. Quote, "the room still seemed too small to contain him," unquote. Of course, this is literal and metaphorical. All that he is, who he is, the lives he's led cannot be packaged into one human body. And yet they are. His rooms are decorated eclectically. Deb tells us through Diana's eyes. The furnishings, quote, "gave the rooms the atmosphere of a select Edwardian gentleman's club," unquote. Across the room, a table with his academic detritus. Each pile of papers was weighted down with paperweights, from a piece of heavy-blown glass to an old brick to a bronze medal and a small fire poker. Also on the table were beautiful Georgian silver candlesticks, mix-and-match wine glasses, plates, and even more silver. Diana, looking at all of this, sees it how perfectly it reflects Matthew. Quote, "I love it," she says. And, quote, "It was all perfectly, quintessentially Matthew," unquote. Now, he has no kitchen. They don't believe in at least making your food there, but they can drink and make do. And also, no fire making. They can't light a fire. I mean, they can, just not of the flame.
Mm-mm. He had to have at least a kitchenette.
A what?
Like, he doesn't have a kitchenette. He had to have
He may have had a microwave, you're right. He had to reheat. So he may have had like a toaster oven or something. And he had a small refrigerator, yeah.
I was going to say, he had to have at least a small oven because there's no way a chef in a restaurant is going to give someone detailed instructions on how to not burn something in the microwave to reheat it.
So his most recent journey to or arrival in Oxford was 1989. He's telling Diana the story. And we learn about Matthew, but also about All Souls College. He was a prize winner, and there are only two of these given out each year, and he was elected a fellow by members of All Souls. Ready to believe anything now, Diana asks if he'd been in All Souls before, but he laughs and says, no, it's the first time All Souls had bothered with him. She's thinking of all the degrees and studying he must have done and doesn't hear him when he asks her a question. She says, quote, "It's like a disease. I can't keep the curiosity at bay when you start reminiscing," unquote. I like that for our title, Sam. It's a disease. It okay. is. If it's like you get me started to talk about something that I'm interested in, and it's like a disease. I can't stop talking about it. I mean, hello. Matthew is in the best mood ever. Quote, "I know," he replies. "It's one of the difficulties a vampire faces when he spends time with a witch who's a historian." Too much, those two. Sorry, that was a little bit cackly of me. She retorts that he can avoid such difficulties if he avoids the Bodleian's paleography reference section. But he's not interested. Mm-hmm. Quote, "One historian is all I can manage at the moment," unquote. And I wrote, aw, he's managing her. As he helps her up from the chair to get some grub, Deborah teases us, quote, "We stood facing each other, our bodies nearly touching," unquote. And, quote, "His eyes flickered over me, leaving their trail of snowflakes. You look lovely." He puts a piece of hair behind her ear, and then he strokes her skin to the base of her skull. Diana has to be in heaven. Who does not like their head massage?
I don't like a bad head massage.
A bad head massage?
Yeah, I don't like bad massages in
general.
I don't
think anyone likes bad anything.
You either got to know. I'm not just going to carte blanche say I love head massages because I don't. I've had bad head massages. I've had massages in my life where I'm like, stop touching
me. Okay, speaking of head massages, you and I share a hairstylist. We won't mention her name, but have you ever gone to her and, well, not ever gone to her. Have you ever, okay, do you enjoy when she washes your hair?
She and I have had conversations about the fact that she has told clients in the past that she has a no moaning rule.
I must have talked about this before because I didn't want to assume that you had had this conversation with her. But yeah, I've had this conversation with her. You've had this conversation with her. And she has, okay, say that again. So explain what she has said.
She said she has a no moaning rule about people who get when she's giving someone a shampoo. She says it gets awkward really fast and it makes her uncomfortable. But my question to her was, does it feel when you give yourself, mm-mm. when you shampoo your own hair, does it feel that good? And she's like, no. So I'm like, you can't do it to yourself.
Seriously. Okay. Speaking of, it's not like good, like a head massage, but it's funny about, you know, how you say things you can't do to yourself. Like, it's very difficult. At least I've never been able to tickle myself, for example. But I was at the physical therapist recently for, I have a foot issue that is being monitored, and I'm in physical therapy for something. And I don't know why. She's like, okay, we're going to do the sole of your foot now. And I'm like, what? Because I've been going since August. She's never touched the sole of my foot. Like, only. If she's like held my foot to do something on the top of it, fine. But she's never like applied anything to the sole only. And this came, I'm like, is this a new thing? You're just springing at me now? I mean, I don't mind, but do what you got to do. But wow. So, and that's the first thing she said. And then she said, now just know that if you're ticklish, it can be awful. Like, you're just going to be prepared. And I'm like, oh gosh. Now, Summer, between you and me and everyone who's listening, I once in the spring or once in the early summer, I try to get a minimum of one pedicure a year just to keep, you know, have decent feet looking at the beginning of summer or something. Well, it is hard for me to get pedicures. I love the massages. I love the whatever. I love the care, the self-care. But I feel it is so hard for me not to like kick someone, not because I'm upset or hurt, but because it tickles so dark. I'm so ticklish. That's what I'm trying to say. So the physical therapist, like, I don't even know what she does. She had like, I don't know what she had in her hand. I was on my stomach and my foot was behind me, so I couldn't see any of this. I don't know if she had an instrument or just used her hand. She had to have an instrument because this was not, it was so strong. I know this was a medical facility, so I'm sure that people are used to all kinds of sounds. Summer, I was cackling and laughing. I was crying. I was so ticklish. And whatever she did was so bad.
Or so good.
Oh gosh. No, it wasn't like that. Cause that would have been a different kind of sound. No, but it was so ticklish. I didn't scream, but I almost, it was borderline that. And I was like, are you kidding me? And I felt like such a nutter because she knew it. She's like, I fully expect, she's like, everyone I do this, everyone like laughs and like almost screams and cackles because it's so ticklish. So don't worry, you're not going to hurt my feelings. You're not going to make me feel uncomfortable. I'm like, okay. I was cackling like a nut. I mean, it was embarrassing. Then I had to like say goodbye and put my shoes on and like walk out past all the people whose desks are 5 feet from the door that I was just behind. And no one like gave me any kind of side eye, but you got to think that when you leave those appointments, they're talking about, oh my gosh, did you hear that one?
I just want to know if you peed a little.
If I peed? No, I did not. Thank you very much. So anyway, yeah, speaking of head massages, I wouldn't expect anyone to like any kind of bad massage, but as long as it's a good massage, then it's not just like, oh, I like a massage. No, there's something about head massages. You're just like, ugh. And that's all I'm going to say. So let me back up a tiny bit. Diana has to be in heaven. Who doesn't like their head massaged? And by Matthew. Quote, he lifted my hair away from my neck and let it fall through his fingers as if it were water. Unquote. I mean, that's just mean. Matthew is starting the foreplay. He loves her hair, he says, and we get more of a description of it. Quote, it has every color imaginable, even strands of red and black. Unquote. Now, Matthew picks up a new scent. Her. She finally meets his eyes and breaks the moment. Quote, shall we have dinner? Unquote. He then serves their dinner of fresh oysters on crushed ice. Oysters and
that
champagne.
That was not dinner. That was an appetizer.
Well, he begins their dinner. That's the first course. Mm. And he easily pops the cork of the bottle free with his hand. Dude. He toasts her à la tienne, which is, it's French for cheers. It literally means to yours or to the, well, okay. I'm breaking it down. Idiomatically, it's cheers. Or to you. But literally translated, it's to that which is yours or that which belongs to you. So to yours. Yeah. We get more wine education thanks to Deb and Matthew. The bubbles are so tiny, as Diana observes, because of its age. and that vintage was 1961. Deborah further beautifully describes the meal, quote, "I tipped the contents of the first shell into my mouth. My eyes popped open as my mouth filled with the taste of the Atlantic. The creaminess of the wine and the oysters collided with the taste of sea salt in ways that were utterly bewitching. As if the whole ocean is in my mouth."
Seriously, unquote. That line. I listened to this chapter like four times this weekend. And every time she said that, I was like,
"Ugh." Because like
it was, no, I didn't. I don't like anyone saying it was like da 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 in my mouth. Because then I'm, whatever it is, I'm now imagining whatever it is being in her mouth. And I'm like, oh, the whole ocean. There's so many things in the ocean I don't want in my mouth.
Fish poop.
Fish poop. any kind. Well, I mean, I'm
fish
not.
Eggs.
I don't. Right? Pee.
Semen.
Yes. That's also in the ocean, and I don't want it in my mouth. Sand. Don't want that in my
sand.
Mouth.
Sand. Oh.
Seaweed. Yeah. Not a huge fan.
We can keep going. But yeah, lots of stuff. That's actually a nice call to what I said earlier about Matthew and all of his lives and learning being stuffed into his one body and mind. Quote, "the whole ocean in my mouth," unquote, is like all of Matthew inside of Matthew.
Thank you for not saying
next
in
up,
my mouth.
Summer, that's just wrong.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
That's not till book two. Hush.
Oh,
I'm just kidding.
I don't remember that.
Next up, salad with partridge with her birthday wine, quote, "which smelled like lemon floor polish and smoke and tasted like scotch and butterscotch."
Like, for yum. Real, that description did not sound delightful to me.
Lemon floor polish did not, no, but scotch and butterscotch, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, but I'm like, if I smell something that smells like lemon floor polish and smoke, I'm not putting it in my mouth.
Like the ocean.
I'm not putting the ocean in my mouth.
Then they have a stew, veal with apples and cream, served atop rice. And he says the recipe was from Normandy. He didn't make it, he said, but he did reheat it, for which Diana rewards him with a flirtatious, quote, "you can reheat my dinner anytime."
Like I said, worst flirter ever.
That's true.
From
maybe Diana and I have more in common than I think. I'm not a witch, but we're both bicentennial babies. We're both Leos, and we're both extremely bad flirts.
From the ocean in my mouth to the next thing. I'm just like, oh, girl.
Girl. Okay there, Dee. You're flirting right back now, aren't you? Or at least attempting. So she notes that he's not eating, and he says he's not hungry. The next wine, Chateau Margaux. Quote, "some people consider it the finest red wine ever made," unquote. Diana describes it, and this, like, I want a bottle stat. So she describes, "violets, like drinking velvet, milk chocolate, cherries, then something that reminded her of her father's study, and then something that reminds her of Matthew. Spicy." Matthew then tells her all the things. And of course, I mean all the things that are in the wine. And with such specificity that it's unbelievable. Quote, "blackberries picked wild in the hedgerows outside the old lodge's stables and red currants macerated in brandy." Unquote. I mean, mic drop. You can't ever get past that. Sorry. It's just, you're never going to best Matthew on this kind of thing. And then the wine clearly affecting her, she asks, that shall not be asked.
Do you know how much we know that the wine is affecting her?
Because she asked this?
No, because this is her third glass of wine.
Oh, that's true.
And she says, "I've only had two glasses of wine." And this is her third glass of wine she's currently drinking. So she clearly cannot count anymore.
Well, she asks the question that she should not ask. Quote, "what do you think I would taste like?" Unquote.
Again, awkward.
Now, before we get to his reaction, I am actually, was it a smart thing to say? No. But, okay, she's had a little wine. Matthew is just talking about all of these things that the wine has in it. And he's asking her what you taste in the wine, right? And she's explaining what she tastes. And then he's giving her like the a description of what's in there and what also what he tastes. And she is on the same topic. She is not trying to make it bad or dangerous or nasty. She is just on the same topic. Well, oh, well, you taste this so well. I taste XYZ. And your taste is amazing, your ability. I wonder what I taste like. What do you think I taste like? Because she has just told him it tastes like you. Because spice, clove, cinnamon, that kind of thing. So she's not trying to get down and dirty or dangerous. She just wants to know, in return, what do you think I taste like? But then she realizes, oopsie.
Like I said, phrasing yes. everything.
Yes.
The things that are coming out of her mouth on this date are not her best work.
So he reacts in a flash. He jumps up and he is furious. He pulls her up from her chair. He jumps to the vampire legend about where the vampire can't help himself but drink her blood. And she was literally only asking about her taste. In the same way, she said she could taste him in the wine. But she realizes what she said. He's not letting go so easily, though. Quote, do you wonder what it would be like for me to taste you? Unquote. Matthew's voice dropped from a purr towards something deeper and more dangerous. For a moment, I felt revulsion. That's a change, right? Right there. That's a change. I think, even though it was an accident on her part, she asked maybe not so innocent question. She didn't mean it in the way he took it, but he responded as a vampire would respond and scared her enough. I think it was probably a good thing. Scared her enough that she felt a little revulsion. And he was trying to scare her, though, obviously. And so that was probably a good thing. He lets her go, but then he holds her head, his fingers again in her hair, and she feels almost drugged. He goes on to describe just how she affects him. Quote, it's not only your scent that pleases me. I can hear your witch's blood as it moves through your veins. Did you know that a witch's blood makes music? Like a siren who sings to the sailor. The call of your blood could be my undoing and yours. Unquote. Holy dang, Summer. Then he starts to kiss her along her jawbone. What a sensation, that Deborah describes. Quote, each place his mouth touched, froze, then burned as my blood rushed back to the skin surface. Unquote. Now she feels mesmerized. This is not a word I believe that Deb uses. However, in anything from Bram Stoker to any kind of vampire movie or book that's been out there, one of the things that, before they even bite the woman, but one of the traditional or classic things that a vampire can do is mesmerize its victim, right? Like, or hypnotize, but look at them and then entrap them with their eye, with their look. She feels mesmerized. Quote, I closed my eyes, expecting to feel teeth against my neck, yet unable, unwilling to move. Unquote. So, yes, unwilling, but mostly unable because that came first. And then Matthew goes to town. Quote, Matthew's hungry lips met mine. His arms locked around me and his fingertips cradled my head. My lips parted under his, my hands trapped between his chest and mine. Underneath my palms, his heart beat once. Unquote. And then he changed. Quote, hunger in his touch turned to something bittersweet. Unquote. This is the Matthew we're used to. We're back with the Matthew we know well, know better. He gently ends the kiss, and she also hears him breathing. Quote, for the first time, I heard a soft, ragged sound. It was not like a human breathing. It was the sound of minute amounts of oxygen passing through a vampire's powerful lungs. Unquote. Of course, in Matthew, true Matthew fashion, he feels awful and he apologizes, and I think rightly so, for taking advantage of her fear. She's still wrapped in his cinnamon and clove scent. He knows himself, but he is still a vampire. Trying to protect her, he tells her that if she moves, he might not be able to control himself. She opens her eyes. His face was hungry. She tells him, I'm safe with you. quote, a witch, save the vampire. Never be sure of that. It would only take a moment. You wouldn't be able to stop me if I struck, and I wouldn't be able to stop myself, unquote. He's really scared for her and impressed by her bravery. Quote, how brave you are, he says to her. She's not so sure, but he says the way she meets a vampire's eyes, how she ordered the creatures out of the library, and that she goes back day after day refusing to let people keep her from what she wants to do, that is bravery. Diana, still coming to terms with herself, allowing herself to embody her full witchiness, her full self, immediately recalls that Sarah would have called it stubbornness.
And I would have called it mild stupidity. And underestimating the people you're dealing with.
That's very fair. So I have to take a second here. I got really verklempt here in this scene.
Really?
Yes, it's hot and bothered, huh?
I said, really? Verklempt?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. Yeah, I did, actually. Yeah, it's hot and bothered, and we want them to get together already, but Deb is showing us both of these characters. It's deceptively easy to focus on Matthew here, since we're learning things about him. But consider Diana. He tells her she's brave. The first thing she says is, I've never been brave. And then she replaces it with the word stubbornness when she recalls what her aunt would say. How much Diana has to learn about herself, not just her power, yes, but about her personality. She is so tightly wound up, so living from a place of fear and not wanting to let her true self out, she can't even appreciate when someone else sees in her and compliments her for it. I can totally see myself in Diana here. No, not as a witch and not with a vampire. But as far as not accepting something, especially positive, that someone else says. And I think many women can as well. It's so easy to shoot down compliments or offer a different word for what we see something as. Even for our wonderful heroine, it's difficult to recognize and then admit positive things about ourselves. So that's why I got a little verklempt there, because there's the surface story, which the words you read, and then there's the meaning of what they might or might not be for the characters, and then there's what might hit you in the heart or in the gut as a human being that has absolutely nothing to do with the characters. It's kind of and it may not be a lesson she's trying to, or a message she's trying to get across, but even if she wasn't, I got that. And that kind of stopped me for a minute or two. Matthew tells her he has known courage like hers. He's seen it, and it's mostly women. Quote, men don't have it. Our resolve is born out of fear. It's merely bravado, unquote. He sits her back in the chair and crouches next to her, sad. Quote, promise me that you will never joke with a vampire, not even me, about blood or how you might taste, unquote. She apologizes and gives him full eye contact. Now that, Summer, is courage, doing something in spite of fear. Deb writes, quote, forcing myself not to look away. If you have to force something, that means it doesn't probably come all that easily or naturally. So that is definitely courage. He warns her that no vampire is immune to such temptation. Quote, vampires with a conscience spend most of their time trying not to imagine how people would taste, unquote. This whole time, she's been aware of the ampulla of Bethany. And Deb brings our attention to it. I think first as they're walking, she sees, or as they're getting close to entering All Souls College, she sees it there. And then now when he's bending over, it's like the third time I think she's mentioned it. When he bows his head, it tumbles out of his sweater neck. And so this is a constant reminder. He is struggling greatly. Quote, witches and vampires aren't meant to feel this way. I'm experiencing emotions I never, and she understands, and says, I know, I feel them too. He then clasps her waist, and she moves closer to rest her arms on his shoulders. It's a beautiful scene or tableau here. How this moves from like boyish or kind of teasy, really happy Matthew as they go to All Souls, get into All Souls, and then get further into his rooms, and then more serious Matthew, and then freaked out Matthew, and now kind of a very serious but very heartfelt Matthew again. Now Diana takes the conversation elsewhere. The fifth question for his prize fellowship. There were actually only five questions, he told her, but a fifth was just a word, if you made it that far, that is. His word was desire. Matthew says that there are only desire and fear. Diana thinks this is a brutal picture that he paints and notes that love wasn't part of that worldview, but she does see truth in it. And it's understandable as a vampire. Quote, his desire for blood chiefly was so strong that it put everything else at risk. Unquote. Now, witches have to manage impulses too. Quote, much of what qualified as magic was simply desire in action. Quote, unquote. And, quote, a wish, a need, a hunger too strong to be denied. These could turn into deeds when they crossed a witch's mind. Unquote. She tells him our now famous line, quote, magic is desire made real, unquote. More, so we're getting here more of an education of the witch. More behind the scenes of the witch. Quote, when a witch concentrates on something she wants and then imagines how she might get it, she can make it happen, unquote. And that's also why she has to be so careful in her work. And then he calls it, quote, then you spend most of your time trying not to want things just like me, for some of the same reasons too, unquote. So basically what Deb is introducing us to here is that they are both prisoners of a type. Both deny themselves things they desire, and that is things that come naturally to them. He says that she earns everything twice over, first by not taking it, and then through work and effort. They retire to the sofa, and he brings an ancient black bottle with amber-colored liquid. She smells flowers and nuts and candied lemons. And she says it smells like the past, but not the dead past. It's alive. Unquote. Something ancient and powerful entered my bloodstream. This must be what vampire blood tastes like. Unquote. She's drinking Malmsey from 1795 from grapes grown in Madeira.
So for those keeping track, this is glass number 4. That makes this one entire bottle of wine consumed.
They chat more about All Souls and Hamish, the other prize fellow, and their time together at Oxford. So remember that Matthew met Hamish at Oxford, correct? And now we find out that he was the other prize fellow. So no wonder, because Hamish is brainy as well, crazy smart, genius. Tired, she has to tell him her decision before he takes her home. Quote, I made a decision, Matthew. On Monday, I'll be recalling Ashmole 782. Unquote. She'll give it the old college try, haha, lol, but she doesn't know how she broke the spell the first time. This confuses Matthew, and she says that she broke it without realizing it. He freaks the freak out, and he asks if Knox knows that she didn't use witchcraft. And Diana still doesn't know, and she doesn't understand. She doesn't see that it matters. She's like, how does this even matter? Matthew clarifies it for all of us. It matters because if you didn't break the enchantment, then you met its conditions. Right now, the creatures are waiting to observe whatever counterspell you used. Sorry. Quote, it matters because if you didn't break the enchantment, then you met its conditions. Right now, the creatures are waiting to observe whatever counterspell you used. Copy it if they can, and get Ashmole 782 themselves. When your fellow witches discover that the spell opened for you of its own accord, they won't be so patient and well-behaved, unquote. She's not having any of this. The spell is more than 100 years older than her. It's not possible. She's in danger, however, whether she recalls the manuscript or not. She says, vampires were fast, but magic was faster. So what's their plan? She'll sit near him. She says it's not reckless, but she wants her life back. She refuses to stay in and not do what she needs to do, and she wants to move forward. Again, we see a sign that Diana is growing into herself. Quote, I'm not going to be bullied, unquote. And she says this looking into Matthew's eyes as he's included, and he's included in this. Sorry. And she says this looking into Matthew's eyes as he's included in this. As he walks her back to New College, he wouldn't let her through the back entrance. He wants the porter to see her safely returning with him.
I thought that was hysterical.
That was, it was so funny. Because I guess, remember when he picked her up, the porter was like not...
He gave him the once-over.
Exactly. He was like, are you sure you want to go with that dude? They're strolling hand in hand. And the next day, he says he's going hunting. She is staying in to write letters of recommendation. As he goes, or before he goes, he kisses the hollow of her palm as she goes. Now, the last time we accompanied her to her door, she noticed the tightened handle. Now, she notices there are scratches on the hardware and the wood. Remember this. When she gets inside, she notices there were messages on the answering machine. And when she turns to wave at Matthew, he is gone. So, a lot of summary here, but the reason I had so much summary, and we still discussed stuff, but the reason we had so much, I believe, so much summary from this chapter is that there's so much dialogue in this chapter, and dialogue-heavy chapters, you don't need to obviously parrot everything that she gives us, that the author writes, but so much that is said, or I should say, the stuff that I quoted was not the stuff about the food, except for the part about the ocean in my mouth. I quoted that. But most of it was a paraphrase of describing a meal or something like that. But a lot of their dialogue with how close they got, how physically close they got, how they were feeling, etc. A lot of that was legit taken straight from the chapter because so much dialogue this chapter. And I think we learn more about Diana in this chapter than Matthew, but we still, one of the most important things that we see is that they, to me, the most meaningful line of the entire chapter is when he, and let me find it, when he starts to say something and then he breaks off. He says, "Witches and vampires aren't meant to feel this way. I'm experiencing emotions I've never..." And she finishes his sentence. She says, "I know, I feel them too." To me, those two sentences wrap up the entire chapter. Neither of them know what the hell they are doing. Vampires are not supposed to be like this. Witches are not supposed to be like this. It is not supposed to happen like this. And they both agree with that. They both understand and recognize that. But there is this attraction. And yes, of course, outside of the attraction, they can help each other. He can help protect her and she can help, you know, with his studies and hopefully help get answers to the genetic problem, because there all these people are dying out, or these creatures are dying out, not populating like they used to do. So they definitely can help each other professionally, but there is this attraction that just will not quit. And so it's fun to see them kind of dancing around it. And, you know, yes, when they kiss and it's titillating, it's great. But at the heart of it, these two people don't know what the heck they're doing. They both had relationships. That's not what we're talking about. They know, or it's not that they're uncomfortable with relationships. It's that this type of relationship is taboo to their knowledge, doesn't exist. Not only is it taboo, is it illegal or not supposed to happen, it's just not possible. It's not in their schema. It's not in the realm of possible. It's just not in their life. And so they are, and their friends, or at least their close friends, of course, are navigating this as well. And they will kind of adjust themselves to however Diana and Matthew end up. Like, as their relationship develops, so do the relationships of the people around them to her, of course, and then to him. But those who already were part of his pod are already part of his kiss, I guess, are already there. But yeah, it's fascinating. Don't you agree that this whole chapter can be summed up in those two things? Because all the stuff she did, not stupid, but the things she said, maybe partly because of the wine, but also because she just is clueless. She's not clueless. She just doesn't think, or didn't think. She meant it innocently, I truly believe. But she didn't think three steps ahead of herself, which is what she needs to do with the vampire. And why? Because this is not supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's rules against that, laws in place, pacts that have been followed and, you know, enforced for ever.
Totally. And so what do you think? Do you think those two lines kind of sum up the entire chapter pretty well? When he says, witches and vampires aren't meant to feel this way. I'm experiencing emotions I never. And she says, I feel them. I know I feel them too. Those two lines, I think, are the heart of the entire chapter. Everything leading up to that and everything after that is they're in it. They're both choosing. No one's forcing anything. They're both choosing to stay there and play around with what they're feeling and experience something that neither of them is really, really, no one's, when can you ever be ready for that? You can't be. And he's not used to not being able to know things and do things. I mean, how smart is this man? How many degrees does he have? How long has he lived? And yet he is like a child, not literally, but he, in navigating this, there's no blueprint. It's just not, no one has a blueprint for this. So I think Deb has done a wonderful description, not just in those lines, but in this chapter of, you have the romance part of it. You have, okay, the whining and dining, literally. You have the sharing of the past, mostly on Matthew's side, but hers as well, as far as the witch side. So you have the sharing, you have the romance, and then you have, of course, the danger when you realize, oops, I shouldn't have, I said something I didn't mean in that way, but you know, that shows her inexperience. That shows her not thinking ahead. And so it's so exciting. I mean, obviously you feel bad for her, kind of, and a little bad for him, because then he goes back to his kind of sad self. And, you know, you really want these people to be happy together. And they are happy together, but they're not able to be happy, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, together. But it's just, it's fascinating to watch this.
All right, so that is chapter 14. Join us next time when we will be discussing Big Shock, chapter 15. I'll come up with a tagline for that one later.
So thank you guys for joining us on our discussion of chapter 14. Please send us an email, tweet us, send a comment to our Instagram post for this episode. And you can find us in all of those places at All Souls Pod. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.